The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Runes, the 2018 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2018. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Well, let's go back to the basic story elements of the Greeks. There's a three-act play. And story structure is establishing the story, and then you have to basically, in the advertising and marketing world, we call it the temporary suspension of disbelief. So why would anyone even be interested in your 30-second commercial, or you telling somebody a story, or you writing a book, or you presenting an idea, a PowerPoint, creating a film, writing a novel? In each case, there's a kind of story. And if it's a story that involves a sense of curiosity or wonder, or you're telling something that's fictive, or you're telling something that's truthful, but you have to use a metaphoric process, the first thing you have to do is get people to be willing to hear your story. And in a sense, there's a resistance factor there. So in advertising, we say, and in filmmaking, you have to overcome the temporary suspension, create the temporary suspension of disbelief. That's the starting point. So resistance is a disbelief factor. How many people believe you can change their lives with whatever it is you have to offer? How many people believe that they want to change their lives? How many people believe, given the context they're in, that you have something that has value? So that's the starting point for any school, any individual. And most of you, I would guess, probably, given the size of the school, and let me get a feeling for measuring that. How many of you have a school with students that number over 800? So there's some big schools represented here. How many of you have a school that's over 500? Okay. How many of you are over 100? Okay. We're getting into that certain range. How many of you have less than 100? You're early in this journey. Okay, great. Wow. Excellent. I would reckon that the first thing you want to do, and by the way, I want to introduce my friend and colleague, Todd Nichols, here. Todd, would you stand up just in case I get carried away? Todd's come all the way from the mountains of North Carolina, where he lives in Cashers. Did I say it right? I always want to say Cashiers, but... And Todd has worked with, he's finishing his PhD in philanthropy and leadership, and has done a lot of research, has worked with Regent University, and has worked with some of the biggest and most significant influencers in Christian charity and philanthropy. I won't go into the names except to say that he has been witness to some of the biggest opportunities for giving and for raising funding. And Todd and I, we've been friends for almost, 15 years, Todd? Todd was helping an organization place funding along the Gulf of Mexico after Hurricane Katrina. I was down there helping another organization get young people down there to work on rebuilding. And we found out along the way, this is an interesting marketing story. We found along the way that high school and college kids that wanted to come down there were a threat and a danger to themselves and other people. They had good intentions, but they were coming by the busloads from all over. Todd verify this story. They were coming from all over the country with a heart to serve, and when we got them down there, we found that these kids had never handled power tools. Many of them never even handled a hammer and a saw. So what are you going to do with them? So the organization that brought Todd and I together had a circus tent set up, and it was essentially a staging center, an orientation center. And they started setting up pennants from all the schools and colleges. Were you down there? You're nodding. You're nodding knowingly. So wherever there's a problem, there's an opportunity for a creative solution. So in the midst of this, we started thinking about how do we train these kids? And we went to Craftsman Tools, and we started Black & Decker, and we said, could you give us some video? And these kids, by the way, had earbuds on. This isn't that long ago. This is, you know, probably even before, you know, when you think about it, this is just before smartphones. But they had a way to listen to things and learn things. So we realized that we had them on a bus for hours and hours and hours coming down to the Gulf Coast. and in that area, Louisiana, and we weren't in Louisiana. Were we in Louisiana, Todd? We were in Mississippi. And as they were coming down, we thought we could use this time to train them so they could be watching videos and learning how to use power tools so they weren't a danger to themselves and others. So there's an opportunity using that downtime. That's how Todd and I met. And Todd was, he's been a program officer for major philanthropies. He's seen both sides of it. He's advised clients. He's helped organize. He's helping me right now. We're basically turning around a Christian school that's been around for 71 years. It's an interesting story, too, because it's from a particular Christian sect with a unique theology, shall we say, Church of God, Seventh Day. And over the process, their leadership actually had a process of metanoia. They had a repentance moment. They said, we've got our theology wrong, our Trinitarian theology wrong, and some other things. And so they were able to acknowledge that they wanted to change. Very interesting story. This is some years ago, probably 15, 20 years ago, I think. But in the process, this school had never been acquainted with classical Christian, the academic model, the classical. Oh, thank you very much. So we met them quite by, Todd was up visiting me at my home in Michigan, and we met them, went to dinner with with the chairman of the board and some others, and they started telling us about their challenges and their goals and after 71 years. And this resulted in an engagement for us to be able to start steering them toward the classical Christian model. We just took them, maybe 6-8 weeks ago, we took them out to the Ambrose School in Boise, and they were overwhelmed. You know what it's like when you first see the classical model working and working well in that environment, a K-12 environment. And they were so inspired. Now they're reading everything they can. It's a transformation. And how many schools exist out there today, Christian schools that just haven't yet had that exposure and contact where they've experienced their own epiphany? So we've had there have been many challenges with this. Todd will tell you it's probably one of the most challenging school boards that he's ever worked with, and he's worked with a lot more than I have. But we've really had a terrific time, and it has challenged us. As I said earlier in my talk at 1 o'clock, it's challenged me spiritually, not to be cynical, but to see how they can change. And it's really caused me to pray with faith, and I've seen how God has been showing up in their life. It's marvelous. And one of the youngest members of their staff, I think he is the youngest member of their staff, in his mid-20s, 27 years old, is, I believe, probably going to become head of school someday. He has a passion for what he's seeing. He's reading everything we give him, every bit of advice we've given him. Now, he needs experience and maturity, but it's really a remarkable story. And we'll tell you more about that as we go on. So let's go back to your story and how you tell your story. The story is going to be different depending on the context. A 30-second commercial isn't going to cut it if you've got to tell a story that has novel length, or if you're creating a cinematic story through a movie. Now, I had the great advantage of getting around some Hollywood screenwriters years ago, probably 8-10 years ago. And I realized the importance in my business in marketing well, that's a different, that's interesting. I was looking at this slide. What it did for me is awaken me to the power of story structure, why we have to tell stories with that kind of structure. And I got an opportunity to work with the screenwriting department at the foremost film school in the world, the USC Film School in Southern California. Now, it's interesting that between George Lucas, who gave him over $250 million, that's a nice endowment, right? And Steven Spielberg, who was never admitted to the USC Film School and still gave them another $250 million, they have two essential opposing quadrants in the campus there at the film school that were funded by Spielberg and Lucas, whose infrastructure reflects a $500 million commitment to the school. It's really extraordinary. Why? How do they make so much money? Why do they invest this money? Why is it so important? Because our whole culture is built around story. And I want to submit to you that the people in our culture who have the best storytelling skill, have the most pervasive audience, have the ability to penetrate that audience and convince them that their stories are true are essentially the people that are shaping our culture. So classical Christian education has got to get in the story business, because what are we doing? Well, essentially, as educators, you're curating story. Does somebody want to close that door in the back? Thank you very much. You're curating stories. So if you begin to think about your curatorial skills, how do you identify stories? How do you tell stories? And by what means are you telling stories? And I would suggest to you that aside from big data and the whole shift that's going on in marketing, marketing won't look anything like it does today in another 48 months. In 4 years, what I'm telling you about marketing is going to be so tailored to individuals at a whole new level with AI and machine learning and all the big data resources that we have today. We don't even know where it's leading. I'll give you one example. I know a guy who's the world telematic, he's the world subject matter expert on automotive telematics. So they're looking at all the data in your car to learn new ways about designing cars themselves. When you get into your car, what do you do first? Some people turn on the electric heater, adjust the seat. They might want to turn on the radio as soon as they start. They do a number of things that are all different. We're now studying this in Detroit in the automotive industry in ways that detect what kind of patterns are specifically correct, and they can program the cars now to start doing the things you want them to do. Warm the car up early. You've got an app now on your phone, your smartphone. You know this. You can start the car from inside. You can do that with your key fob. But you'll be able to do much, much more than that. It's all changing. In fact, the manufacturing is trying to keep up with the information we've got that will affect how we transport. The other thing that's happening, of course, is autonomous driving. We're not there yet, but we're only 48 months from approximately 30%, well, a third of all cars in 4 years. If they're on track, and I was in Ann Arbor at the Ross Business School at the University of Michigan last Wednesday afternoon, listening to the latest presentation on this. It's really going to be, get ready for future shock, as Alvin Toffler used to call it. Anybody remember Alvin Toffler? Three of us. anyway, he was the most pronounced, and then John Nesbitt, Megatrends. Who remembers that came after Toffler? Okay, great, cool. And I mentioned Jacques Ellul earlier. Surely many of you have read Jacques Ellul. No? Okay, wow. There's a rich repository of information on the technological society written by a French Christian intellectual named Jacques Ellul, E-L-L-U-L. And it's extraordinary, hard to get through. His work is very, very, and the French translations from the French are okay. He also wrote the sine qua non book on propaganda in 1963. Nothing has come close to beating it. If you want to understand something that was mentioned this morning, the chattering classes. Why do everyone have to have an opinion about things? Why is it dangerous that we think we expect people to have an opinion about everything with scant information to supply it with real insight or truth? But these are the times we're living in. And to enter them and to engage people in three factors, I would imagine, you know what you want to do with them. You want to, A, for anything to be successful in communications, you have to raise awareness. So while you're thinking about crafting your story, you have to do what? Raise awareness of what? That you exist, for starters. So the first thing we do frequently as children to make our presence known, raise awareness, is reflected in our behavior. Somebody's the class clown, or somebody's clever, or somebody's funny, or somebody's kind. But we're all in life, are we not? To reaffirm our sense of presence and that we make a difference and have value is raise awareness. So think about that individually as you participate in your school life and think about it in your school. How are you raising awareness that you exist in your community? And I want to make this more interactive. Maybe you can tell me some of the things you do. One thing you can do is create a dialogue, create a community conversation, write letters, and you've just been schooled in this in the last session, using social media, but even writing letters to the newspaper, if you have a local newspaper. My small town in Michigan, in Owosso, Michigan, has the oldest family-owned daily newspaper left in America. That's pretty significant, isn't it? Yet our schools have not used it as a forum. So we're underperforming in that way. And that, especially this new Christian school is now using it and now has a presence in the newspaper. And that creates all kinds of relationships. Newspapers are dying, but they're still relevant to people. How many of you watch some level of television, news or something on some occasion? How many of you would admit that you watch television at all? How many of you really have eliminated television from your lives? Okay, and I see that trend in the classical movement too, and it makes sense. But still, television is with us. Television has huge audiences. I work with television. I produce and do local television. I don't work in New York with the big budget stuff we used to, but I'm still trying to help people use television as a tool. It's a very effective tool. It's a very cost-effective tool if you know where to get the right distribution on cable in your community. And it can be a great tool for telling the story. Again, we're storytellers. You could get a 60-second commercial that you'd be surprisingly affordable just to raise awareness. So for any of our communications or marketing to be successful, we have to raise awareness and essentially create an appetite for what you have to offer. It was said earlier that the association, I think Davies Owens made this comment, that people have very distorted associations when we say classical Christian school. It may have nothing to do with what we esteem to be so valuable and so precious and so important. But if people don't have a familiarity with that, what are you going to do? So here's the next question. How many of your schools have produced a video or using, and I want to know, is there an ACCS video that you can use just to generally tell the classical story and then tag it with your own school address? Is there? How many of you are using the ACCS video? I would highly recommend that as a way to just make your presence known. Why? The beauty of linear video like that, even if it's 60 seconds, is you show something that is a composite of what kids are experiencing, the joy. There's a certain warmth. There's a certain, I would even say, there's an intelligence to what we convey. There's an order. There's a structure. How is that subtly conveyed? Uniforms. There's a sense of freedom, but also discipline. There are a lot of ways to tell these stories, but we have to make people aware that we exist. And there's a wider and wider audience out there that you may not be connected with. How many of you have maxed out your student availability? Nobody's maxed out. One school. How many students do you have? Wow. Excellent. Where are you located? Yeah, that's got to be very gratifying to be maxed out. Are you going to add capacity? What's the plan? Many universities, as you know, my family's been connected to the University of Michigan Ann Arbor for three generations. My grandmother got a master's degree, which they called a special degree for women because it was 1923. What's a woman going to do with it? Seriously. And she went on to become the director of social services. They didn't call it social work then, in Detroit, Wayne County. First woman to do that. And she was a Christian, and she had gone to Oberlin. How many of you know Oberlin? And, of course, Oberlin was the first college to admit women. Did you know that? First college to admit Negroes, which is how it was described then, which was very advanced. And you know the whole story of the sort of the second great awakening that took place there and how Charles Finney came from New York City. It would be like a Tim Keller leaving at the height of his influence and saying, I'm putting all that behind, I'm going to go pioneer something new. Oberlin College's motto is labor and learning. And so by working at the college, you worked off your tuition. And they had wagon readers. And wagon reader was somebody in the morning when you're out laboring in the fields or milking cows or working in the apiary or whatever. They had all these very industrious. And they'd have wagon readers reading the scripture in the morning. You'd have personal devotions. They'd read scripture in the morning. They'd read the Greeks in the afternoon. So they had so while you're working, you're hearing something. They didn't have iPods, apparently. So my grandmother graduated from Oberlin College, first member of her family. Her father was from English descent, her mother was German descent, and they didn't encourage that kind of cultural intermarriage in Ohio, so they moved to Michigan to escape that stigma. Isn't that interesting? But in that process, you think about these colleges that had learning laboratories, And wouldn't it be interesting if we went in and challenged some of the existing university learning laboratories with our ideas? And I think this is where we've got to create more awareness and more engagement and show the kind of results we're getting. I mentioned earlier a friendship with the Secretary of Education and what we're trying to do. She's bewildered with the amount of variation that she has to look at in all the different schools. There isn't a one-size-fits-all solution. And I think as a country, we've got to acknowledge, and of course, the NEA and the teachers' unions are loath to acknowledge this because they feel it will ultimately lead to the demise of a model that hasn't worked in a long time for lots of reasons, obviously including Dewey. But we've got to raise awareness that we have an alternative. Now the next question is it an affordable alternative? And what do we do when schools move toward desire to be more aligned with a prep school identity than the classical Christian model? How are we going to maintain affordability? And is that even a concern? How do you approach that? Again, it's got everything to do with your story, individualizing your story, but these are the ideas that are out there. This is the competitive environment. First, do people care? B, can they afford it? C, is it relevant to their needs? D, are you reaching the accessible market universe you have amongst the faith communities? We weren't. This is something Todd and I are discovering. How many people don't know within their own communities how fragmented it is between the homeschool movement, between what we have locally, a Coram Deo that meets once a year, the bridge movement that Ambrose has started. How many of you are starting bridge schools like Ambrose? Are you familiar with the Ambrose bridge movement? So they're basically tapping. I'm sure Davies is going to talk about this at some point and others. They're tapping now the homeschoolers in and around Boise Meridian and bringing them into a 1, 2, 3, I think it's currently a 3-day complement to homeschooling. Brilliant. They filled the 100 spaces they had, they filled it right off the bat. So here's a marketing question for you. Is that a model that could work for you? Because we've got to scale to a level of acquaintance and engagement that will be affordable to people and get them excited about it. And there are a variety of ways to do that. So again, if one size does not fit all, then what are we learning about the customization of our educational model and how it fits in our various communities? How many of you know the Arete Scholars program in Atlanta? Anybody know that program? So Arete goes back, does it go back 10, 15 years? And it's a program where to create scholarships for kids to go and get classical Christian education in Atlanta with corporate funding because of the tax advantages that existed. So there's another model that's going to allow you to do something really, really unique if you study what's going on in the changes in tax code and state by state and advocate for it. Ultimately, we're going to see that free markets and a more competitive model for education is inevitable if we're going to even survive as a culture. We can't keep going the way we are. I said this earlier, I'll repeat it again. And it's pretty obvious to me, standing from where I am, my perspective here, that we are not exactly a technicolor audience. I don't see an enormous amount of ethnic or racial diversity in our group. I don't think that's an intent to keep others out, but I think it probably reflects some kind of cost structure. And I know my friend that I'm closest to, inner city African American pastors who are my friends, who really educated me on the challenges they face in Detroit specifically, and they want school choice. In fact, if you talk to the leaders in many of your inner cities, they want school choice as much or more than anybody, but they're being stifled, and the political powers that they have in the past adhered to are setting that agenda, and it's not working, and it's debilitating. So somehow I would submit to you that in our communities, in the safety or security or comfort or convenience of our communities, we have to step out and start a conversation. Maybe it's an ACCS level conversation where we can give to, support, somehow tithe to or invest in other communities and their success with the classical Christian model, because we believe it works. But does it work across the whole spectrum of socioeconomic concerns and situations? Let's prove it. So, again, this is part of our story. Now we're part of Act 1, Greek model. We're setting up the context. The people care about their story. They want to enter your story. You have to make them aware that you have a story. So what's the second act? How are you guys doing with this, by the way? How many of you feel like you're master storytellers in your school marketing? Seriously, I'm not saying you are, but or you've got a level of competence that you feel really comfortable with. So tell us about your storytelling. Where's your school? Can everybody hear? Tell us what that message is. Can everybody hear? Do you want to come up? I don't mind you coming up so we can. Yeah, thank you.
And faith. It sounds like a very commonplace message, but it's actually I think a sector of higher education that's sparsely populated.
Yeah, that's excellent. Give me a couple other examples, pass the microphone, of people who are experiencing success in the starting early stages of your storytelling. I want to hear about your stories. Thank you. From the Ozarks. Thanks, Todd.
The College of the Ozarks started as a grammar and lab school in 1906 in the Ozarks as an answer to the poverty in that area. An early Presbyterian minister, missionary, traveled there and saw the poverty and said, "We've got to start a school." So it has always been a work school. The college is one of seven remaining work colleges in the nation where the students pay no tuition. Instead, they work 15 hours a week at an on-campus job and work at least one 40-hour work week at the beginning or end of the semester. The classical Christian school that we started in 2012 follows that same model. We ask families to pay $2,750 in fees. They submit a family financial aid statement, and their fees are reduced based upon that statement. Our target is to have 90% of our students on financial aid. So I was just telling Aaron next to me, that's one of the reasons why we're full, because it's for families that couldn't otherwise afford this type of education, and it's at a greatly reduced rate, fully funded by the endowment of College of the Ozarks.
That's fantastic. How many other schools have endowments or you're starting endowment programs? Say again. I'd like to hear a couple more of these endowment stories because I want to connect it to the need for story. There were some other hands back there. You have an endowment. Will you tell us your endowment story? There were several hands up. Thank you.
This is what I get for raising my hand. I guess.
Can you tell us where your school is?
Yeah, Regent School of Austin. And we started an endowment probably 7 or 8 years ago. The goal was to obviously one of the goals is we wanted to protect the school in terms of potential liability. If there was a gift that came to the school, the endowment could receive it and it would protect the school corporation from potential liability with a gift, like for example, real estate. We have a fundraising gala every other year, and it's finally cracked seven figure. It got into the seven figures, and we use all the payout for tuition assistance. And so long term, we're trying to think strategically on how to grow it with the goal of being supplementing tuition assistance. So we have a commitment out of the tuition dollars of about 9% of all tuition dollars go to tuition assistance. That equates to over $1 million in that pot, and so we're trying to build the endowment to supplement that. We're not quite as aggressive with the College of Ozarks, but we really want socioeconomic diversity if we can. And so that's the goal of the endowment. But
is there a better way to do this besides endowments? Because I haven't heard of any. raising additional capital
you end
you
up
don't
with
need for
a,
operations.
You end up with an annual fund kind of scenario, which makes, well, we felt uncomfortable about it because typically annual funds are you budget to spend more money than you raise, and then you have an annual kind of fundraising operation to come up with to cover the shortfall. And that type of hard sell isn't something we're comfortable
yeah.
with.
Well, I want to give you a marketing suggestion that's just, I really feel came from the Lord. As I was praying about this for these clients who we're working with in Michigan, I suggested this young gentleman who's working in their marketing department. Says, how many people have you met in the community? Have you met the stockbrokers and have you met the financial advisors in our small community? We're a small community, 25, 30,000, but there are many, many wealthy people who don't display it very openly, but they're farmers and people who have old investments and so on. Anyway, he went to the three major brokerage firms in our town. Already, three of the three have responded positively. Says, we think we know clients who are retirees or getting older or establishing wills and trusts and estates who would be interested. They've already received two gifts and a commitment for a seven-figure. We don't know if this will happen as a death benefit or how that will take place, but a seven-figure commitment. And this was from the first brokerage firm they went to. They'd never knocked on their door before. And they were met with that response. We think we know somebody interested. I want to ask you, how many of you have literally canvassed, the investment advisors and brokerage firms and in your community? Nobody. I want to suggest to you that it's a fantastic opportunity. And I'm just saying that based on one anecdote experience. But I believe if people, again, it's awareness. That's the first part of our story. It's awareness. And then there's some level of engagement as there's complexity in the story. So this has been extraordinary. We'll keep reporting to you, but they're going now to more and more brokerage firms, and not one has turned them away. Not one has turned them around. Every one of us says, we think we may have a client who's interested. So why aren't we doing that? There's a great opportunity. We've guided him to create a pitch deck, and I want to suggest a book for you all to look at, which is really excellent. Todd, you had your hand up, and I want to get your comment too. We suggested they get a pitch deck together, and the book is called Get Backed, GetBacked, two words, Get Backed, by two dear friends of mine, Evan Baer and Evan Loomis. It's the number one selling book from the Harvard Business Review Press last year, and it's the most practical book on putting together your pitch deck. So we just advised this young man to get a pitch deck together and go out and talk about alternative education. Let him know that it's Christian. But basically, go to people and say, are you satisfied with the educational choices you have in your community right now? Very excited about this. Todd, you've got an insight there too, I'm sure.
I was just going to share about endowments. 5.5 years at Regent University. Be careful of that language. Endowments went negative a number of years ago. Right now, things are obviously looking better. But a lot of your philanthropists are still very skeptical. I have a client, and I legally can't give you name in this audience, but if I did, everybody here in the room would know who that is. We specifically spoke about legacy versus endowment. So you just a little thing there. You want to be really careful using that term. And if you can show a philanthropist how you can use their dollars today versus out some period of time, that's a bigger sell. Again, I understand the reason for endowment. I totally get that. But again, you really want to think through your terminology and how you're communicating that.
That's excellent. And I wouldn't be able to help this school without Todd. I'm sort of the marketing and ideas and communication and connectivity. And Todd is he's gotten this board with an alignment and a vision that's just been tremendous. It's just been we've been so gratified. We've kind of, pulled our hair from the roots at times with a little bit of, there are challenges. But we're seeing this school overcome the challenge. The other thing, and I want to throw this out to you, is that this is a faith-driven idea. But in my state, my mother had a stroke 10 years ago. It was debilitating, and I'd spent most of my career in New York and London and Zurich, and I was working at a think tank for the Union Bank of Switzerland in Zurich, and I got the word that my mom had had a stroke. They didn't expect her to live 7 days, and she lived 7 years. And it was one of the most extraordinary faith buildings. It just it radically impacted my lack of a theology of healing. I didn't have a theology of healing. I said, if it be thy will. That was about it. I couldn't quote scripture. I didn't have any aggressive posture on it. And God just did a wonderful work in me. And my mom lived 7 years, had a complete rig. It was wonderful. But in that process, it brought me back to my home state of Michigan. I've inherited my great-grandparents' 112-year-old house there, so I hang out there a lot. And I've been reacquainted with a lot of people in Michigan. I've started asking these questions. When we were at Highlands Ranch, I saw like how you've impacted your community there, and I thought, I don't think my vision is big enough. And I got to start the conversation somewhere. So this has been my marketing approach. I knew one person who knew another person, and I said, why don't we invite the most influential people in our state to get together and become friends who want to try to solve problems together rather than being mandated by the state or by a policy forum where they sit at these round tables. We have something called the Business Leaders of Michigan, BLM. 91 business heads from Ford Motor Company to Whirlpool, the biggest companies in our state. But most of these folks have never gotten to know each other as friends. So I have a friend who owns a sort of really nice golf destination. I don't know if you have any of your golfers, but it's really beautiful. It's Michigan. We only have 2 seasons. We have 9 months of winter and 3 months of tough sledding. And it has really been that like that this year. But anyway, a dear friend of mine has it's called Bay Harbor Golf Club, and it's one of the most, probably on the top 50 or 100 golf courses in America. Just beautiful place, private golf course, and has some other features around. But he's invited us to come up and bring people. So I've been inviting these guys through this network to just come up and play golf together. And these guys are thrilled. So we play golf and we have a lunch together, and Steve brings in a chef from like this Culinary Institute of America. I'd say CIA, but it's not a spy. And we've just started this conversation. And I would reckon that most of these individuals are not, they don't share the faith. The majority, but it creates a context for friendship. And I'm excited to see where it goes. And another friend of mine was just with Bill Ford. Bill Ford doesn't know, I mean, I could tell you all the names. I'm not trying to out the individuals, but they're terrific people with extraordinary experience, and they haven't met each other. So I don't play in that, I don't play in the Billionaires Boys Club, but I love to get people together. And it is so far 15% of my inquiry attempts have been met with a positive response. So I figure maybe I'll get 50% of the top 20 or 30 or 40 influencers in my state. But that's a start, isn't it? And I'm going to get to the point when building friendship, building trust, to say, what do you think our best alternatives are in education? And you know what I'm going to present to them. I'm going to take them to. I've already invited the Secretary of Education to come out and see a class. I don't know that she's ever actually been in a large, successfully run classical Christian school yet. So that's going to be an exciting moment. So that's the vision I have. I don't know why. It's not like I've got a big stake in this, but we all do. I'll say what I said earlier today. No matter what we fix in this country, no matter what improvements we make, no matter what happens to the economy, no matter what infrastructure reforms take place, if we don't reform education with something as inspired as the classical Christian education model, we are just looking at a terminus point in our national horizon. You know this isn't an exaggeration. There is no model that is going to change. Technology is not going to save us. I'm speaking at a conference with Pete Thiel. You know Pete Thiel? Invested in Facebook and so on. Big Silicon Valley guy, but Pete and some of these other guys that I'm hearing that I don't know well, but I read what they're saying, they're very concerned about the machine age and AI and where it's going, and we should all be. But I think if we're going to hold this torch forth, if we're the ones who are going to tell this story, how well are we telling it on the front lines of marketing and presenting and raising awareness of what we have? Let's go on. I want to make sure that I get to answer your questions, and I don't want to just give you theory and ideas. And these aren't just theories. These are things that are working. And I can't tell you that, you know, read this playbook and do the same. But if you're not talking to investment managers, we're in the midst of the largest intergenerational wealth transfer in history. We're right smack dab in the middle of it. Between the greatest generation, World War II generation, went through wars and the Great Depression. My mother had a coffee table book. Wonderful book of photos of how people were brought together during the Depression. The title of the book, We Had Everything But Money. And my mother told touching stories about how neighbors would go and borrow a cup of sugar, do something. We wouldn't think twice about going to bother a neighbor. We don't need our neighbors. We don't even want our neighbors. Well, think about it. It was a different era. People had front porches, so they'd sit out there and wave at each other walking by. It was a different era. So these are all things that we have to reckon with, but we've got to get our story. We have perhaps the only robust solution that's going to really turn our country out or give us a last great hope, and however that fits into your eschatology. But tell me the challenges you have. Do we have 10 minutes left? 5 minutes? I want to share some of your questions, concerns, or successes. Thank you.
I'll tell you a challenge. It's pretty fresh.
Hold the mic a little bit closer.
Sure. I'll tell you a challenge because it's pretty fresh. I shared with you that one of our lines, one of our stories that we tell is that we're challenging the status quo in Christian education. And 2 weeks ago, I was at a secular conference on marketing and branding, and most of the schools in the room were 5,000 or more in student population, so they're huge. And they don't worry about some of the same things that we do, such as keeping the doors open. Trade school, like a community college in Michigan, was using that tagline, and they were saying that they're challenging the status quo in education. So I threw my chair back and I thought, well, who's the status quo then? You know, so to put a question to this, then the challenge in messaging is we all start to sound the same. We basically aren't adding anything new or fresh. You know, even in the ideals, in the session that came in this room just before this one, the ideals that are up on the screen, every school in this room would say, we resonate with those ideals. That's the product that we're delivering. But I dare say ACSI could be in the room and they would look up there and say, that's the product we're delivering. And I'm just concerned that, you know, how do we really differentiate?
Oh, it's all about that, and that's probably not the best place to finish where we are, because that's a whole conversation itself, and a critical one. But I want to say one of the things we can differentiate is by our actions. For example, one of the ways we solve, I think, the need for an inner city model that's going to work is for us to consider, as the ACCS, another way of giving. We're giving back to the organization, and what a great conference this is. But what if we had an additional tithe or dispensation of funds? I know it's tough, but what if we set as a goal a desire to put together a fund of our funds that would allow us to invest in inner city schools? How many schools are thinking beyond their own walls, beyond their own needs? It would certainly be a statement to other schools that we're not the status quo. That's one thing. Secondly, I really feel it's very important that we really engage in conversation in our communities, that we really not remain isolated and say, look, we all want a better future for our kids. Yeah, you know, and this is going to be the big debate of the next few years, is public education even going to survive, or how do we move people toward something that's going to be more sustainable? The other thing that's really critical for you, this is a key marketing piece. How are you tracking your students? How are you tracking your alumni? Because kids are graduating now and they're going on. Like I worked with Campus Crusade for Christ once upon a time when Bill Bright was like, Bill Bright, this is such a great story, I'll probably cry again. Bill Bright gave me a big, when I realized that the person who led me to faith in college was a crusade guy, Bill Bright gave me the biggest bear hug when he was alive and said, I'm your spiritual grandfather. It was so cool. But Bill Bright, with Crusade, what was problematic with them is he wanted to create groups of spiritual entrepreneurs, not separate them by silo, but because of the fear of losing donors, they weren't communicating. So when you go through student venture in high school, and get to college. They weren't communicating. They weren't saying, we're sending you the following students. And then when they go to graduate school, they weren't communicating with the graduate school outreach. And then they were going into their first career post in a new city through that organization. They weren't communicating, so they lost touch with them. What if you communicate with your scholar students for a lifetime? What if you had an annual magazine or a quarterly magazine, an alumni magazine for the ACCS, for all the schools, with great stories, honest stories, stories of kids whose faith is challenged? You think 100% of them are going to go through college and not have their faith challenged and maybe not report that they're struggling? How about we're just honest about it? Say, the stories of those who struggle with their faith. At least we still have that coherence. We still recognize that we are a family, we're relationships. You look at kids that go to Yale or come out of Skull and Bones or these secret societies, they're global influencers. What if we created something that wasn't a secret society but nevertheless had the characteristics of a cohort, of commitment for a lifetime? I said this earlier, we're in a leadership crisis. Leaders all over the country are living alone. They don't have close relationships with other peers. Men more than women, but there's a sense of isolation that that means I have to wrap up this talk, and I'm just getting started. I want to tell you something. There's a group in Michigan called Foster Coffee Company. Go online. These are my guys. These are my boys. I've mentored these guys and loved these guys since they were in college, and they've started a successful coffee company. It's dedicated to community. Look up Foster Coffee Company. It's in Owosso, Michigan. They've made an offer to me to present to you, which is they are willing to because they have a roastery and they want to get their coffee out all over for great causes and for community building. They're going to offer you coffee at bulk rates, at wholesale, for you to use for fundraising. So contact me if you're interested. They have my contact details, and I want to get you into another layer of marketing and fundraising that I think will be a lot of fun. I'm so glad we were able to interact in this way, and I'll be here for the next 2 days, and I hope I'll get a chance to speak to you more individually. And thank you for your patience.